And welcome to your economic show entitled Money Matters. Before we begin, discussions in this show cannot be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Indices possibly mentioned on this show are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Investing involves risk depending on the types of investments. There may be varying degrees of risk. Investors should be prepared to bear loss, including total loss of principal. And the views expressed are my opinions only or the opinions of authors or guests that I may read or have on the show. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, the station, and staff members or underwriters. Today's show is 285, the 285th show in titled Will April Fool Us? Because we're into April 4th. Money Matters is about money. Money is matter, and matters of money affect us all in some way or another. Whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it, it controls our economy, our country, our planet, in some way or another, controls the very way we live our lives. It's about your money, lack of it, or abundance of it. It's about our lives and livelihood. In short, Money Matters is about you. So 2 weeks ago, we did a show called Our Corporations People. That was a great show. We got a lot of good emails on that. Nice objective view. Not subjective, objective. Okay, so out today, preliminary reports, public traded company. This is not a solicitation or recommendation to buy or sell any security. Preliminary reports on the Boeing 737 MAX 8 Ethiopian airliner mishap crash, killing all 157 people on board. Turns out human error was ruled out, according to the info on the black boxes on the preliminary report. And the airliner, the fated airliner, 1 minute into the flight after taking off, reported a little trouble with the autopilot. 3 minutes later, radar picked up the fact that the plane was accelerating past safe speed. And it was changing altitude radically. Pilot then asked to return to the airport and was no longer seen again until they discovered the wreckage on the ground. This was the same MAX 8, Boeing 737, that was that had crashed in the 6 months prior by Lion's Air. All passengers and crew killed there as well. Turns out the Ethiopian crew was certified as the plane was certified, and they were also instructed and given schooling on what to do in case a similar problem may occur. And you can imagine that they, too, may have had problems with the autopilot. They call it the MCAS system, M-C-A-S, because the 737 has its engines kind of way up front. The MCAS system is designed that if the plane is climbing too rapidly and it'll sense a stall, not sufficient enough airspeed to keep the plane aloft, it will point the nose down and possibly accelerate the plane to keep it from stalling. So the thought being, of course, Boeing has not been charged, or there's no definitive report, but the thought being that a sensor may be responsible for telling the aircraft it is stalling when it is indeed not stalling, and it will, the autopilot would instruct the plane to nose down and unable to switch off the autopilot. It's possible that that is what may have preceded the unfortunate event. I'm friends with a pilot who's a Thunderbird pilot. He flew in Iraq and Iran wars. We had him actually on an interview years and years ago. And he's not certified in the 737 MAX 8, but he is certified on a number of planes. He flew the F-16, the A-10, the Warthog. He flew the Jump Jet Harrier and the Stealth Fighters and Thunderbirds. He flew the F-16s, and he's flying corporate jets now. And just talking to him, he said, you know, Mark, there is usually on the right in front of you, a big red button that disengages the autopilot. He wasn't speculating. He hasn't read the report, but he's saying generally there's a big, you know, big button that says disengage. But he doesn't know what's happening in 737. So we don't know what will happen. The 737 MAX 8 is the best-selling aircraft that Boeing has. There's 300 of them now grounded worldwide sitting on the tarmac. And we don't know when they will be allowed to fly again, if they'll be allowed to fly again, and what that will do to the company. So again, we never know what will happen with the company when things of this sort come out. So again, this is not a solicitation or recommendation to buy or sell the security, just informational. So let's talk about the Dow. Is April here to fool us? We are at 26,370. The high being around 26,008 something, somewhere in there, or 9 something months back. Dow only, of course. And we've talked on every show that these large numbers below us and above us are what some technical analysts regard as support and resistance levels. So they kind of work like this. 26,370 is where the Dow is today. It has a number. It's up 152.27 today. And since it's at 26,370, it's over 26,000, right? It's higher by 370 points or so. And so it is regarded by some analysts that 26,000, the big number, 26,000 below us is support. And that 27,000 above us is resistance. And so 2 weeks ago when we did the show, the Dow was sitting around 25,700 something. So we mentioned that 26,000 above 25,007 something was a resistance level. And apparently it has climbed through that. And now it has support underneath it. So say the technical analysts. We can never tell which way the market will go, of course. And so that's how we look at it. Okay? So we don't know. You know, will April fool us and give us a head fake? Economic stats are not too terrible. There's something going on called a partially inverted yield curve. Now, what is that? Well, it has preceded recessions in the past. It is not exclusively accurate, but it has preceded the last three. And what does that mean? Yield curve. Well, yield is what you get paid, right? A yield is what you get paid. You buy a CD and you get a yield, whatever a CD pays you. You're commonly referred to as interest. So, normally, we have a rising yield curve, and that means that if you buy a six-month CD, it pays you a certain interest. And if you buy a 10-year investment, 10-year CD or 30-year treasury bond or whatever you buy, the longer out you commit, the higher the interest they pay you. I think everybody pretty much knows that, right? You buy a 3-month treasury bill and you hardly get any yield, any interest. Commit your money to 30 years and you get much more. So it rises. 3 months, 6 months pays more than three, a year pays more than one, three pays more than one. A year pays more than 6 months. Three pays more than 1 year. 5 years generally pay more than three. 10 years pay more than five, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what that means. That means that the longer you commit your money, the higher your yield, the higher the interest they pay you. Well, when I say inverted, an inverted yield curve, right? An inverted yield curve, a completely inverted yield curve, would mean that you get more money up front for a 3 month than you would for a 30-year, right? Now, that's odd. Why would that be? A partially inverted yield curve, which means that maybe the 3 month is paying more than this 1 month, and the 6 is paying more than the 3 month, and the year is paying more than the 6 months. But the 3-year might be paying more than the year, but the 3-year might be paying less than the 10-year. So if you bought a 3-year CD, it would pay more than the 10-year CD. So, and then the 10-year CD would again reserve the upward trajectory of the curve, and a 20-year might pay more than a 10. So the only anomaly there would be the 10 years paying more than the 3. Right. So why does that happen? Well, the price of these things is dependent on the demand. And the more the demand, the less the lender has to pay in interest. So if I was trying myself, Mark was trying to float an IOU, let's call it a Mark bond, because a bond is just an IOU. So I'm trying to borrow money. And let's say I come out and I say, okay, I've got a loan that I'll pay back in 3 months, and a loan I'll pay back in a year, and a loan I'll pay back in 10 years. Okay? If there's a lot of demand for my three-month IOU, and a lot of people are coming forward and say, I want to buy it. I can drop the interest on it because there's so much demand. It's like, I don't have to pay 3% or 1%. I can pay 0.75%. So if the yield is dependent on the demand, if there's no demand or very little demand, I have to raise the interest rate to entice somebody to lend me the money. So I raise it to 3, 2 people come forward, I raise it to 4, 5 people come forward, and so on and so forth. So when you have an inversion in the yield curve, let's say the 10 is paying more than the 10 is paying less than the 3, one of two things is happening. Either there's more demand for the 3, which would drive the yield down, or there's more demand for the 3, which would drive the yield down, or less demand for the 3, which would drive the yield up. So when an inversion takes place, one of the two things got to be happening, or multiple variation of these two things. Either the demand for the 3-year, right? The demand for the 3-year is falling, which means the 3-year yield is going up, or the demand for the 10-year is rising, which means the yield drops. So the one in front, the 3-year, may be seeing decreased demand, right? Because the yield is rising. And the 10-year may be seeing increased demand, which means the yield is falling. Now, why would people not want the 3-year and want more 10-year bonds? That's what it's saying. When the inversion takes place between the 3 and the 10, the 10's playing us in the 3. That means more people are buying the 10 than the 3. Proportionally, not really proportionally, but kind of conceptually. So what that means is that traders, or investors, let's say, or traders, there's a little bit of difference there, have a healthy appetite for the longer securities, especially in the 10-year range, which is dropping the interest rate. Now, what that normally indicates in the minds of these buyers is that I don't want to buy a 3-year treasury or CD, but I do want to buy a 10. So that's basically saying I don't really trust what's going on in 3 years because I'm really not buying a lot of those, but I'm buying a lot of 10, so I kind of want to lock in a higher yield. Because before it inverted, remember, the 10 paid more than the 3. So a lot of people came forward and said, ooh, I want to buy a 10. 10-year, we'll get that good interest rate. And more people that bought it, the more the yield fell. And so that's kind of saying that investors or traders are kind of have some intrepidation about the future. Now, when their yield curve inverts more, if it continues to invert, that would be a sign that perhaps there is some worry about what is down the line, kind of medium term. Yield curve has inverted completely before And it usually signals a recession, in the opinion of this analyst, when it fully inverts. You're should be toward the end of whatever's happened, but not necessarily so. So when you see it fully inverts, you probably just came through a storm, an economic storm of some sort. It's rare to have it completely invert. And it would mean that people are buying, you know, since the yield curve usually goes from 3 months to, or a month, you can buy a T-bill for 30 days, out the 30-year bonds. Usually if it, the 30-year bond is paying less than a 3-month T-bill, that's a pretty, you know, eye-popping event there. It means that people don't trust at all what's going on in the economy right away, and so they're going to lock in some good yields later. They're also predicting that if the economy goes into the hole, that the feds will drop rates. And if they have a 30-year bond that's at a particular interest rate, let's say 4%, you're guaranteed the 4% for 30 years. Investors and traders may be in thinking that if the economy goes into the hole, then a 30-year bond, which is paying whatever it's paying, 4%. If the economy goes in the hole, the feds will drop interest rate and you'll be locked in at your 30-year bond at 4 when the new 30-year bonds will be paying 3. So that's kind of what the inverted yield curve means. It is partially inverted now. It's been downward sloping, and now it has partially inverted. I haven't checked it today. I checked it a couple days ago. I'm sure it's probably still partially inverted between the 3 and the 10. So is that concerning? Well, it's something that I'm definitely keeping an eye on. Again, these things are not exclusive. They're not completely foolproof. If it was, then everybody would be smoking big cigars and eating candies and nuts, as they say. So we'll see. I got an eye on it. You know, there's an old adage in Wall Street, sell in May and go away. So as we approach May, I may be more vigilant. Again, that adage may not necessarily hold true. There are so many theories and sayings and technical analysts and everything else that everybody tries to follow and assume that it will tell the truth sometime in the future. And you just don't know. I will say that it is my opinion that the market will reflect reality eventually. But its day-to-day movements are only the perception of all the players in the market at that particular time. And I've used the example before. In 08, 07, when there were a few Bear Stearns, the old firm that's no longer around. Bear Stearns had a couple of funds, had redemption problems. In other words, you couldn't get all your money out. And they folded up those two funds. And they were involved in some real estate. And so even though the housing market was turning, the housing stocks continued to run up. I know, because I shorted housing stocks too early, and that was not a successful trade. I was looking at the reality of the housing industry, that it was turning, and making a bet on that turn, and the housing stocks continued to run. So they, housing stocks were not reflecting the reality of the falling or eroding housing market. They were reflecting only the perception of all the people in it, when the perception was that housing would stabilize. So the market will reflect reality eventually, in my opinion, but its day-to-day movements are only the sum of all the players in it at any one time. So, yeah. So we've always talked about how do you be a successful investor. And by the way, I got a note in my box at the station from a listener saying that I should do a show on the low income and those people that are not wealthy. And we have a version of this show that we do called Investing in Community, where we cover nonprofits and events and even, you know, elections and things that aren't money oriented. nonprofits that usually help people that need assistance, and entities and events. We'll do an interview, or we call that show that particular version of this show. It's on the same time. It's not a different show. I just kind of skew it off. We call that investing in community. So it's not, the show is not only all about investing in stocks, it's investing in community. And that encompasses, I kind of skew off there, because not everybody wants to hear about stocks all the time. I totally agree. You know, majority of people can't afford to buy stock. And so investing in community covers some of the organizations and events that might cater to people that need assistance, or just events that people want to go out, or elections, so we can keep you informed on what's going on that way. Specifically, we have done some shows on the working class, American working class people, but it has been a while, so I'm going to pen a show for that on what we should do. We've always talked about establishing a retirement account, but even then, some people are living hand to mouth. They can't afford to put any money away, and so we'll have some suggestions. So I will do that show, and thank you for that suggestion. It kind of brought that back into my attention. Into my target. Okay, so we'll talk a little bit about knowing where your money is and investing in things when we return in just a couple of seconds. And you're tuned to Money Matters on your community radio station. Normally, we take calls when we ask for calls, but there's somebody calling and we'll see what they want. Oh, looks like they're gone. You still there? No, they're gone. Oh, sorry. Anyway, the phone number, if you'd like to call, if we have some time, is 530-265-9555 if you're listening to the show at a different time than Thursday, April 4th, noon Pacific Standard Time. And you won't be able to call in, of course. And let's see if we have this gentleman or woman here. There you are. Good morning. Turn down your radio because we have a little bit of a delay. How are you?
Yep, very good. Thank you.
Good. What's your name?
Actually, I'm sick today, laying in bed.
Oh, okay. What's your first name?
Ward.
Hey, Ward. You're live on the air. How can I help you?
Thanks. You mentioned a couple of issues that are happening right here in town. One is housing. I was at a Housing Element meeting the other day at Nevada City Hall. Mm-hmm. And the 235 houses are going into Loma Rica Ranch that are going to destroy that piece of property. And, where do we draw the line as a capitalist society of, good of the many versus the developer that says, I can't make money if I make handicap accessible areas, or I can't make money if I do it to a safety standard. But so, when do the people basically win?
Well,
I guess is what I'm asking. With the development, that's going to be 400 houses. That's such a historic piece of land that's just going to be housed over and paved over.
Absolutely. And that's a brilliant observation. I suppose my answer would be that's what our elected officials are there for, right?
Well, we all know that they're on the take. Where do we go from here?
Yeah. Well, I would hope the local people aren't on the take.
City council meeting, it's hard to argue it, really.
Yeah,
they all vote in unison.
I always take a lot of rash for this, for what I'm about to say. I've been on a lot of boards, volunteer agencies. And, you give I hate to say this, you give small people big positions and they, you know, I've been on so many boards that are dysfunctional, nobody can agree. And I know a lot of elected officials here and there are upstanding, you know, honest people. But the elected officials is really, you know, our representation, right? I mean, when they're all on the take, what do? I guess you could say, well, that's what the Second Amendment rights people say. We have guns, not to kill each other, but to oust a, you know, an onerous government if it ever comes to power. But do you not think that our elected officials should represent us? Or you just don't think they do, right?
Yeah, no, I don't think they do. Just like the, you know, 3 years later after the Measure W thing, we're still trying to get a marijuana ordinance in place. We've spent literally hundreds of thousands of dollars on consultants and CAG and demonstrations and renting the event center. I mean, I could go on that one subject, but it's just all this wasteful bureaucracy that seems to be just a delay tactic. So during that delay tactic, they can just run amok and do what they want. So whenever I hear about politicians out golfing, I'm like, yes, go golf, because you're not screwing something up out there, maybe.
You know, what's interesting, Ward, is that when we had the government shutdown and in previous government shutdowns, the markets can and often do run. And people would say, well, how come this government stalemate is not causing the markets to fall? The general belief is because the investors and these large investors, the money centers, like it when the government can't do anything. You know, they think, oh, gridlock's good. There's not going to be any new regulations on us. So
yeah, it can be more efficient when it doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, you know, I'm completely against the lobby system, and I believe that, you know, a lot of boards are dysfunctional. You know, I've never been in a board where somebody said, I want to propose this idea, and everybody in the board said, great, let's all vote yes. It's always somebody's got to put in their 2 cents. You know, it's just, and so I don't know, you know, elected officials do things. Does power go to people's head? Maybe. And I, you know, I've always said that politicians love to spend money. I mean, you can get somebody that balances their checkbook and runs a nice frugal household, and you put them in charge of a public purse, and the first thing they want to do is tax, float more debt, and spend. It's like they want to have their name on a public park plaque somewhere. Or they said, look what I did. I mean, yeah, I don't, you know, everybody that gets into politics, you always see that they say, I want to make this change and that change. And it's usually a pet peeve they have, whether it's about building a park or a bike lane or something. But they always want to do something. I did something. I don't know of any politician, at least in my experience, that gets in there and says, everything's fine. I don't want to do a darn thing. You know what I mean? So when a politician wants to do something, they need money to do it. And when you see 400 houses going up, well, the county's going to, you know, collect a little bit of money on that, you think?
Yeah, that's a city project, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So good comments, Ward. Thank you for calling. Do you have anything else you'd like to say? I hope you get better.
Nope. Just thanks for your show. And I, you know, kind of try to read between the lines on it, even though I'm not at anywhere near the level that your language you're talking at there.
Okay. I try to explain it, you know, as best I can, you know, when I first started the show, they said, oh, economics, that's going to be boring. But my main thing is not if you like the show, but whether you understand it. So I try to make it, you know, understandable. Economics can be so boring, but, you know, it can destroy nations. So, okay, Ward, I hope you get better. Thanks.
Well, even communities. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. All right. So great observations by Ward. Thank you for the call. Next thing I want to cover would be applicable to even people that don't have a lot of money. And it would be, and I've covered this before, it's knowing where your money is, you know, even if you have a little of it or a lot of it or whatever. You know, knowing where your money is and where it's going is an important aspect of survival, you know, of being frugal and accumulating more of it. We have another call, so I'm kind of energetic today, so we'll take another phone call. Good morning. You're on Money Matters with Mark Cunaberti. Turn your radio down. We have a slight delay. Who am I speaking to?
Don.
Hi, Don. Thanks for the phone call.
I just had one other comment about the 400 houses going in.
Sure.
And the government possibly being on the take and getting some money from that whole thing. I think a good example of, yeah, the government will get some money, but they won't do what should be done with it to provide the proper infrastructure to support those 400 houses. I'd say a great example of that is all that development that went out towards the Lincoln area and then turned Highway 65 into this massive gridlock. Mm-hmm. And then later on, the government comes back and they wanted to even put a sales tax on Placer County to fix the Highway 65 interchange, which is a state and federal highway. And that just shows that these big developments, you know, that's just a great case in point. These big developments do not pay their way. So until the 400 houses that are going to go in are going to pay for all the infrastructure that's needed to support those 400 mm-hmm. houses, they should not allow those any kind of projects because they do not pay their own way.
Good comments. Would you like to add anything else?
That's it. Thanks for the show.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. In one of the companies that I own, I do deal with large manufacturing companies. Some of them publicly traded that you probably have their products in your house. And I've seen that many of these plants during the 80s and the 90s and even the 2000s expanded. And when they expanded, being friends of the engineers, because I'm an engineer as well, and when they expanded, they all had very common complaints. Now, I don't know if this is sufficient to explain the previous caller's concern. But I know of one particular plant that was in Newark, California, and they were expanding. And they are not alone in what the plant engineer had told me. Basically, he had to, for the city, build a new street and double wide the streets going in, and he had to pay for partial of a park that was not even close to the plant, and new lighting and all sorts of stuff. So the plant, I don't know, had a $20 million expansion or maybe more. That's not much in the grand scheme of things. And they had to shell out, you know, $3, $4 million because the city basically said that sort of thing that our previous caller had mentioned. Hey, you know, we're going to have to, roads are going to be worn out by more trucks and we're going to have more people police you and watch the EPA and the emissions, and it's going to take more people, so you're going to have to pay. So I have seen, especially at least in the area of manufacturing plants, because that's one of my businesses, what we do, that the cities do make them pay. I guess the question would be, do they make them pay enough? Obviously, in this previous caller's comments, he felt that perhaps that wasn't true. So I guess that would be subjective. Do they pay enough? I don't know. It's a good point. I know I met with a gentleman here in Nevada County a couple of months ago, and he was concerned about affordable housing, as everybody is. And he was trying to get movement on getting some multiplex units built. Now, that's a long slog and a long road. You know, you need investors, and you need the city and the county to go along. And, you know, it's tough. It's expensive to build a big, you know, housing complex or group of houses, for sure. So on one hand, there's people that say we need more housing. On the other hand, we have people that don't want more housing. But I guess the common ground would be a lot of people would say, well, I want more low-income housing. So you could put more homes per square foot, and you could also help people that can't afford to live, you know, because the worst, you know, what breaks my heart is to see somebody living on the street. Now, there are some people that choose to live on the street. There are some people that choose that lifestyle. They want to live that lifestyle. But I would think that the majority of people that I see, it breaks my heart. You know, I go down to Marysville in Yuba City. It used to be bustling areas of manufacturing of tomatoes down there and everything. And, you know, it's really breaks my heart to go drive through there because there's so many low-income people. Now, I have my own, you know, belief on why we're seeing this. It's not the common belief that most people have on why we have more and more poor and the wealth concentrating at the top. And I will specifically aim a show at that. A lot of people, at least that I talk to, that email me, believe that the lobby system and greedy corporations and a favorable tax structure to the rich and capitalistic or profit-driven incentive is driving America into the poorhouse. I would agree with some of that, but the majority of why people can't afford to buy anything has nothing to do with the free markets that are out there. Nothing to do with it. It has to do with another body of the federal government, which we've discussed before, and we'll cover that in another show. So anyway, we were talking about knowing where your money is. And no matter how much you have of it, or even if you owe it, you should know where it is or what you owe. You know, as an advisor, I have clients tell me that they don't want to own this or that because of moral convictions. I don't want to own tobacco. I don't want to own missiles and death. I don't want to own plastic. I don't want to own oil. You know, those are common. Others who I advise and manage for try and second guess the economy based on what they might feel about, let's say, the administration. Maybe they love Trump and they feel the economy is going to do great, or maybe they hate him and they want to pull all your money, all their money out. They might look at the view of unemployment environment, or perhaps which way the wind blows. I had a person actually shake wooden cubes to tell her what stocks to buy. That's a true story. And although not owning something due to a moral conviction, I don't want to own tobacco or oil, I respect that. Second guessing which way the market will go is impossible for the experts, let alone novice retail investors like Mr. and Mrs. Smith on Main Street. We see many times that professional money managers and hedge funds get hammered because they make a mistake and they didn't read the markets right. You can, however, at least get a feel as to what your money is invested in, which would help, or get a feel on where your money is loaned to or who you owe the money to start down the road of improving your financial condition, whatever that may be. Now, I don't expect everyone to fully understand the entire investment makeup of their portfolio or indeed the market. Indeed, Warren Buffett said that he didn't even understand the complex structures of derivatives. He said, it's so complicated, we own some, but I don't know what they are. But knowing at least what asset classes you're in, or who you owe, and what kind of companies you hold will go a long way in improving your knowledge of money. It's like I know where my kids are every day of the week. Well, I don't know where my college kid is. He's supposed to check in at 8 o'clock today, and it's what? 12:45 and he hasn't checked in. Oh, he checked in. He used another excuse. Every day is an excuse. We had an agreement before he left that he's supposed to phone me between 8 and 9 to make sure that he was up. So yesterday he missed it. He had an excuse. He was in the shower. I guess time doesn't mean much to him. Today his phone died. And so how do you deal with a kid like this? You know, I love him dearly. But okay. So improving knowing where money goes or where your money is or who you owe is helping you be a better investor or survivor or however you want to call it. Because money is really a sociological study. It's not really a science. The only science of money is $2 and $2 equal $4. That's math. But the science of what a currency is and the science of how people invest is not a science. It's sociological study. For example, let's use an example. Do you think, as a listener, that there is a lot of debt in the world? Is there a lot of debt in the world? Well, if you do, you might not be alone in that thought. There is indeed a lot of debt in the world, and more debt than there was, let's say, years ago. If you think there's a plethora or an oversupply of debt, you might not want to own a lot of bonds because bond is debt. Now, you might say, well, I think there's a lot of debt. I don't want any debt. So that means if an advisor or yourself was looking at bonds, you might say, no, I believe there's a lot of debt. I don't want to own a bond. Now, IOU or debt or bonds can also be held in income funds. Okay, a fund may be called an income fund, or funds that have other names indicating they hold a wide variety of investments, bonds being one of them. Now, not necessarily all income funds or funds named income will own bonds. In my opinion, most of them do. But if you have an income fund, it sounds good, but you might want to ask or find out whether that holds debt, bonds. There's stuff called high income funds or funds that have the name high yield. Now, they might hold what we call junk bonds. Junk is really not a name for something else. Junk is junk. That's why they call them junk bonds. They are riskier than investment-grade bonds. Investment-grade bonds are very highly rated bonds from sound companies and entities. Junk bonds may be debt from companies that may be not as stable, or maybe their finances are not as good as those investment-grade companies. Now, a lot of income funds or high-yield funds will hold junk bonds or some reasonable facsimile thereof along the spectrum of risk because of the higher interest rate that these companies have to pay to get you to loan them their money. So if you have a high yield fund or income fund, it might hold some junk. If you told your advisor or you yourself have indicated that you are a conservative investor, perhaps he placed you in something that has a higher risk than what you want or what is, might be appropriate. Knowing what is risky and riskier and what is safer will help you steer him or even your own brain in the right direction, right? Maybe he took a wrong turn, maybe she took a wrong turn, or maybe you took a wrong turn in understanding what your real risk profile is. There are things called momentum funds. Not a lot of them, but there are. Momentum funds I kind of catalog as these guys are sailing in a boat and they see which way the wind's going and they put their sail up and they go that way. Certain formulas and methods are used to track which way the investing wind is blowing. The managers of these funds might put a money sail up to catch it. In other words, the sail just being a metaphor for buying stocks that their models or they think might move in the upward direction because they are moving in the upward direction. There's something called the dog fund, a variety of dog funds. Now, they don't usually hold dogs as pets, but the dog fund is a theory where they buy out-of-favor Dow stocks. The Dow has 30 stocks in it, and what they do is they throw out the bottom one, and they throw out the top one, and they buy a group of the lowest beat-up Dow stocks that are in the Dow and believe that over time they will perform better than the best ones in there. Now, there's also something called an ETN versus what more people know as an ETF, okay? Now, regulators get a little squirrely if I start talking about ETFs and mutual funds. They want complete disclosures there. So I'll just say that there is a difference between an ETN and an ETF. And you should probably Google that up because there is, in my opinion, one may be more risky than the other. ETN stands for Exchange Traded Note. ETF stands Exchange Traded Fund. So the ETN Exchange Traded Note might give you an indication, but Google that up. There are leveraged funds. Leveraged funds ratchet up the risk generally by doubling down or using options. And some leverage funds, many of them, in my opinion, can have an erosion characteristic in them. In other words, if you buy a leveraged fund, the managers of this fund may use options to lever up. In other words, if the Dow goes up 10%, the leverage fund may go up 20%, by example. And conversely, if the Dow falls by 10%, the leverage fund could go down 20%. They can accomplish this by using options and other sort of leveraged vehicles. And if the market goes nowhere, let's say the market stays flat and you're in a leveraged fund, it can experience time erosion because it has options that are time sensitive. And if you understand a little bit about options, they kind of erode in value as time goes on. Or they can. Other options can actually increase. But and so leverage funds, if the market goes nowhere, can slowly erode in value. That's why they usually say leverage funds, you don't even want to hold, buy and hold them forever because they will erode over time. Not always. A contrary fund, and some funds have the word contrarian in them, or a bear fund can be designed to move opposite of the market. So you have to ask if you see a contrary fund or a contrary fund or a bear fund. You have to ask. And if you don't have an advisor, you have to look it up. It may be a fund that's designed to move opposite. They don't invest in bears, but they're bears because they believe, or that fund believes, that they want to bet in the downward direction. You can bet either way, like the whole poker range. Like knowing where your kids are, knowing where your money are, where money is invested, and knowing who you owe and what you're on the hook for, if that's be your case, may be just as important and probably a good practice for you to consider. Okay? So know where your money is. That will help. And finally, will April fool us? I don't know. I know the clock, stop clock, will be right twice a day, unless you have a military clock, then it's right once a day. And if it's stopped. So we'll see what'll happen. You know, a major resistance point would be the previous high, according to some technicians. So I think it would be a common belief that the Dow previous high, which is, if see if I can grab this here. It's kind of difficult to read. Maybe I got to go back a little farther. I'm on the computer looking at a Dow screen. Okay. It looks like right around 26,000. Can't really get my cursor on it. Oh, 26,828, if I'm reading this right. Right around early October in 18 was the Dow high. 26,828, or in there somewhere. It's hard to get my cursor to write on the spot. So, I'm actually looking 52-week range. There we go. Down at the bottom, 26,951. That's the high, 26,951. So that's very close to the major support resistance level of 27,000, isn't it? So we'll see whether we can get through the previous high. It'll be interesting because at 26,951, the previous high, its major resistance would be 27,000. So I think if it vaults over 27,000, some people might believe that's a real good sign. Some people. Okay, I'd like to thank you for listening to today's show, 285, Will April Fool Us? And please remember that discussions in the show should not be construed as in specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. Important investment decisions. I'm an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Keep in mind, indices I may have mentioned are unmanaged and cannot be directly invested into. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Investing involves risk. Depending on the types of investments, there may be varying degrees of risks. Investors should be prepared to bear loss, including total loss of principal. Views expressed on the show are my opinions only, or the opinions of anybody I may have interviewed or articles I may have read. They do not necessarily represent those of Cambridge, this station, its staff members, or underwriters. Our website is moneymanagementradio.com. Everything is free there. It's just a thank you for you in participating in your community radio station. My name is Mark. God bless. Have a great day. It's a gas. Get back.